This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and today I'm really delighted to welcome author Andrea Warner, who has just written a revised version of her 2015 thought-provoking, impressive, very well-written, fascinating, vulnerable, sometimes surprising, and powerful book, We Ought to Know, in which she writes about four musical powerhouses, Celine Dion, Shania Twain, Alanis Morissette, and Sarah McLachlan. These four female Canadian artists became bona fide global superstars while revolutionizing 90s music. So I wondered, what prompted Andrea Warner to write this book? And then why did she revise it so many years later? We're going to find out all about that and more. And of course, we'll be playing some tunes from Celine, Shania, Sarah, and Alanis. But before we meet the celebrated music journalist, Andrea Warner, let me tell you a little bit more about her. Andrea Warner writes and talks a lot. A pop culture expert, Andrea is the author of five books, including two in 2024, two books in a year. Wow. The Time of My Life, Dirty Dancing, and an expanded and revised edition of her first release, We Ought to Know, How Celine, Shania, Alanis, and Sarah ruled the 90s and changed music. And this, of course, is published by ECW Press. Andrea is the co-host of the weekly podcast Pop This and an associate producer at CBC Music. Andrea is a settler who was born and raised in Vancouver on the unceded traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. Andrea, welcome to Finding Your Bliss. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Judy. That was such a kind introduction about my book. And if I went a different shade than like extremely white, I would have blushed, but I'm so pale.
I love that. Congratulations on this revised and reimagined edition of We Ought to Know, How Celine, Shania, Alanis, and Sarah Ruled the 90s and Changed Music. And before we talk about your brainchild, I mentioned this to you in the virtual green room that I read the book, but I also listened on Audible to you reading it. And I couldn't get over how rich and evocative your voice is and really the tone in your voice. And so my first question to you in the green room was, are you a singer? And I know in the book you say you're not, but it really felt like you were from what I heard.
That's so kind of you. I truly am not. Like, I mean, I love to sing and I grew up singing in choir and, you know, in high school and elementary school, et cetera, sing with my family in just like the car or whatever. But like, so for the book launch for We Ought to Know back in October, I had the most amazing experience. There was a drag book launch. It's a drag brunch book launch. Fun. So my wonderful friends at Sleepy Queer Productions put on this amazing drag show.
Wow.
And I was sitting like right there and I was recording a lot of video and I was singing along at the top of my lungs. And I get home later. We have like the most amazing time. There are these incredible performances. I get home later and I'm sort of going through to see what I can post. And I was like, who is this tone deaf weirdo just sounding so wrecked? And it took me too many videos to realize it was me.
That's like hilarious.
I really appreciate that you think that I might be able to sing. And I think like I do love singing and sometimes I'm on key, but at that drag brunch, I was so off key that I couldn't even post a single video because I was singing the absolutely ruining their beautiful performances.
Oh,
anyway.
That's very funny. Well, thank you for sharing that. But your voice, and so everyone, anyone who just wants a real treat to sit back, relax, and listen as well to this book, that's another wonderful way to go on Audible. And it just was so fantastic. So I, of course, was curious, as I mentioned off the top, about how your brainchild, more about your brainchild and what motivated you to write this book and then to rewrite it 10 years later.
Yeah. So I think it was back in like 2013 or 14, I was stumbling through like in some research because I love to do some research. And I particularly you know, I had started at CBC Music in 2012, and I was sort of in that rigorous process of like confronting how we hold up certain Canadian musicians and who we don't. And I was thinking a lot about that, and I was thinking about my own role in it. And then I couldn't help but start thinking of like how I had sort of like really hated two of the artists in the book when I was a teenager and really loved two others. And then I started thinking about my own internalized misogyny and really like doing some work on that. And then I stumbled on this list of the best-selling artists in Canada. And I was kind of shocked and surprised to see that Celine, Shania, Alanis, and Sarah were the four best-selling Canadian artists in Canada.
Wow.
Like bigger than the Beatles were number seven at the time. And then this wonderful little press in Toronto, they were sort of just emerging. They'd had a couple books at that time. They happened to just email me and say, hey, do you have any ideas for books? Like, we like your writing. Which was so nice, obviously.
That never happens. That really doesn't.
I know. Wow. Like, I gotta say, my whole publishing career is a lot of very wonderful people reaching out to me on some level. And then I write a lot and I publish a lot. So like, it's the hustle meets the luck and the privilege, all of that. So it's a real combination. Yes. But yeah, they reached out to me and invited me to tell them some ideas. And so I told them about how these four artists are the best-selling Canadian artists in Canada, and how I had hated two of them and loved the other two. And I thought maybe there was something in there about sort of just thinking about feminism more deeply and me sort of confronting my very gatekeeper feminism as a teenager and like how interesting it was to like come of age between 1993 and 1997, which those are my prime high school years. And they liked the idea. Who knew? and then it was really wonderful but you know, really small press. And so eventually a couple of years ago, they were taking a pause or going on hiatus or whatever. Anyway, I had the chance to have the rights come back to me. So I got the rights back, and I had already had a contract for the Dirty Dancing book with my editor at ECW, Jen Sukfung Lee. She's a brilliant writer as well and an amazing editor. And so when I got the rights back, I just said, hey, is this something that would interest you to perhaps republish? And I could expand on it because a lot has changed for these women in the last 10 years. And I think a lot of things in our culture have changed, some very good, some very bad. And there's a lot more to explore here. And I think I could add to it and like really just breathe a bit of new life into it. And so she was very excited about it and really helped me do that. So I added 20,000 words.
Wow. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I didn't 20,000 words. Yeah. No kidding. Oh my God. Well, you started doing this at age 14. You knew that you wanted to write when you used to write young adult novels in a little apartment that you shared with your parents and grandparents. And before you even had a sense of Joni Mitchell, the beloved singer-songwriter, you cherished the unusual cadence in your head and you marveled at the intoxicating version of A Case of You, which is one of my absolute faves. Like I'm obsessed with that.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've seen, there's a recent version, and this is not Joni Mitchell singing it, although that's the best of all, of course, but it's Noah Reed from Schitt's Creek, my favorite all-time show, singing it to Catherine O'Hara when she won her Governor General's Award in a field because it was COVID with a grand piano. And he's sitting there and singing it. And she's just bawling her eyes out, sitting like on a milk carton or something. And
I might cry right now. Yeah, no, that's beautiful. It's so beautiful.
So I love, like everything you were writing, I was like, oh my God, oh my God. I love that. I love that. And this love for many of the artists you admired in your teens was, of course, juxtaposed, as you've just mentioned, by, and I use your words here, hating Celine Dion, Shania Twain, because you viewed them as the antithesis of everything that you believed in. And now much of this has been softened and tempered in this new edition. But you devote a lot of time in the book to Celine Dion. And my sense was that your biggest problem with her as a feminist, a 15-year-old feminist at the time, was you resented that this Dion, known as the Grande Dame of ballads, was the opposite of what you valued. And you objected to everything she represented at the time. Things like the banal melodrama, terrible cliches about women, songs that were essentially gold-plated crap. You use words like dated, vapid, insipid, devoid of nuance, overproduced. And then you write, and I quote, and God, her writing is so good, guys. You've got to read this book because it's so exquisite. But this line, there's passion in Dion's songs, but it's a sexless passion, like a Ken doll's beige genital wasteland. Wow. That was so evocative. But I think for you, it was this man thing that bothered you the most, that Celine needed a man and wasn't being her own independent self. Can you say more about what it was about Celine Dion when you first, in this first incarnation as a young teen, that really rubbed you the wrong way?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can place myself back in that time so easily. And I have like, obviously a little bit of embarrassment awareness now of like how that, but you know, that's who I was and that's how I felt. And I didn't really understand, I think back then, that you could, well, the different people can do different things and still be fine. And they don't all have to be like me. That was a big learning curve yeah. for between teenager and young adult. Yeah. And thinking that, you know, I had to reject all of the, what I saw as sort of like almost caging that was sort of happening. I felt like Celine Dion wasn't allowed fully to be herself. It was never really allowed to figure out herself because she was always sort of being shaped by these other people and specifically by her husband. And, you know, having gone from sort of child manager situation to husband wife situation in a relatively short time.
At a relatively young age.
At a relatively young age, like everything about that really, even as a teenager, really squicked me out. But I think like the bigger thing for me then was just like, I had this idea in my head. I was like, ugh, women who are just in service of being in love with a man are missing out on so much. And that actually, all they're doing is holding up the patriarchy. And all they're doing is just like, if that's their whole identity, that's what we need to break away from. Like that was my thinking as a child. And I mean, honestly, a lot of it is still my thinking, is that I don't think anyone should be in service of someone else. But I think as I grew up, my understanding of what a partnership could look like has shifted quite dramatically.
Yes.
And I also sort of started to understand that being publicly in love and declaring these things didn't have to be something that took away from you. It's actually quite brave to be vulnerable. And so I think, you know, I didn't really get that when I was a teenager. I really thought that in my brain, I remember specifically thinking when I was like 15 or 16, I was like, well, I don't want to be married. I'm not looking for any relationships. I think that people can be friends and have sexual relationships and you don't have to make love your whole identity. And I still understand that that's true, but you can also, you can be married and you can be in love with someone and that can actually make you stronger. Anyway.
Exactly. And so in this new iteration and this new revision, what changed for you and how are you seeing Celine Dion differently now?
Well, I had already come around a lot about 10 years ago, but I will say my love for Celine Dion in 2025 is a wildly different beast than it was in 2015. Like in 2015, when I first wrote the book, I was like, okay, I've made peace with Celine Dion. I can appreciate her. I can respect what she has done and what her contributions are. I feel like in the last 10 years, and that was probably one of the things I love best about revisiting the book at this point, was really digging into like how she has absolutely just claimed her identity so publicly, so forth. And this is before the stiff person syndrome, before any of the health issues that she's had in the last year, and we've seen how she really, again, with that bravery and vulnerability and her whole heart, just like puts herself out there. Yeah. But like coming into her style self and being like that, you know, that fierce thing, having that collaboration with La Roche, finally letting herself be as funny as, you know, we had seen the dorky, funny side hinted at, but it had often been expressed in these sort of lame, outlandish, over-the-top mannerisms, I think we really saw her, I don't know, I felt like I saw her, and I think she's done some interviews really saying like she truly feels like she is herself now.
Yes.
You know, after turning 50, just having this time, having to be a single mom, and like she's a widow and raising her kids, and she has a pretty great team behind her, and like she is set up for sort of stepping into the fullest iteration of herself.
Yeah, so true. So true. It's fascinating. And similarly, a very similar thing with Shania Twain. I can't believe I'm going to tell you this. I wasn't going to tell you this, but but I'm going to share this with you.
Okay, great.
So for 20 years, I had hair. This is actually short now, but I had hair down to my bum because Shania Twain used to have very long hair and my husband loved it.
Oh.
And I went and I did the work. I was doing exactly what he didn't like. that Celine and Shania did, listening to my man. And I literally just cut my hair. It still looks long to you, but it was really super long. And it was in the spirit of Shania Twain, because my husband was obsessed with the way she looked and I wanted to look like his obsession. So wow, that is bad. And I just want to confess that right here.
Well, honestly, like, I hope that this look, like, you look beautiful. I hope that this hair length feels really good for you. Like, is this what you want?
It's cool. I'm getting used to it. Yeah, it's easier. That's easier. It's great. Also, you mentioned that Celine and Shania were accused of being slaves to their Svengali. I thought that was so well said. The person who exercises a controlling or mesmeric influence on you, especially for a sinister purpose. And that was sort of the feeling at the time, right? And I know this has been tempered and changed, and we're going to get to Shania, but can you just say something about this whole Svengali thing? Because I thought that was really well put.
Thanks. I mean, I really hate how much that sort of factored into my thinking when I was a teenager, and how much it factored in to, frankly, a lot of the press that has consistently, like, honestly, to this day, kind of still follows Celine and Shania to a certain extent.
Yes.
No matter what they've done, no matter how long they've been either divorced from their partner or their partner has been deceased, like, still this idea that they were these puppets, that they were these objects of control for these men in their lives who were molding and shaping them. And that narrative is, it does so much damage. It takes so much agency away from both of them, who honestly both were absolutely, you know, they're the ones behind the microphones. They're the ones who are choosing the songs. They're the ones, like, Shania was producing, co-producing a lot of her stuff and didn't get a lot of say in what was happening. And she has said that, but I didn't know that she was, like, doing all her music videos. I didn't know. There was just so many things that the media perpetuated and stripped from them.
Yeah.
And that was what a lot of the research was coming back down to. And the way that we sometimes, just as people in our culture, don't question the media narratives that are being pushed, because those narratives are coming from places that have bias. And sometimes they're feeding into our own internalized biases, and sometimes they're not. But it takes a really long time to sort of, I just sort of unlearn that and figure out why. why am I believing this? Like, what am I upholding by being complicit in this?
Right, by being complicit in this. Yeah, brilliant. And I think with Shania, it's confusing, right? Because it's like she's wearing the midriff-bearing tops, and yet she's saying, I'm woman, hear me roar, kind of like there's like a sort of a dichotomy, and she's almost saying two things at the same time. What was it about Shania that, you know, and it was also, my man is my everything, I do everything for my man. And I think that was a big part of it. But what was the real thing about Shania that just made you go, no, I'm not having this?
Well, I think, I mean, in the book, I call myself a teenage slut shamer. And I think that that's what that was, in all honesty. Because, like, I would never on this planet in, like, the last 10 or 15 years look at any woman and say, you shouldn't wear that, and that makes you less of a person. Right. Like, that's never what I would do. And I really bought into this, though, when I was, like, 14 or 15, that, like, she's singing these songs that sort of, like, pretend to play with gender, and, or I thought at the time, pretended to play with gender. And I didn't understand, and this is, and again, wow, what a little dummy I was. I just can't believe it. But, like, I really bought into this idea that if you showed your midriff or wore a crop top, that somehow made you potentially, like, an enemy of feminism.
No, I get it, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of us that maybe sort of fed into that a little bit and bought into it. And
Totally.
Yeah.
And now you say, and I read somewhere, it was like, why wasn't my anger directed towards the male gaze at Shania instead of Shania herself? Like, you know, like, and then you write, Shania Twain is at long last the queen of herself. Can you elaborate on that? I love that one.
Thank you. I am so, honestly, so happy for Shania Twain. Like, again, if you had said to me when I was 14, hey, are you going to be a big champion of Shania Twain? Never would have said yes.
Yeah.
Now I feel so hopeful for her. I just feel like she's having fun. She's taking ownership, I think, of a lot of decisions about her, about a lot of decisions about her music, about her image, about her legacy that she really wasn't encouraged or allowed to sort of, like, take ownership of before.
Totally.
And I feel like she is sort of gearing into a space where she can be that mentor to a lot of other rising stars and emerging stars, and hopefully sort of encourage them to always stand up for yourself. Because I think like, I think that's the big thing that she kind of learned, and she had to learn with such a public scandal of what was happening behind the scenes was probably 1,000 times worse than what we were seeing publicly.
Yes.
But it was messy.
Yeah.
And it's messy in a way that, weirdly enough, I think some people really, really relate to. And a lot of other people can at least empathize with and sort of understand the really human experience. But like, even just like fully appreciating the fact that she made 4 amazing albums and then she was like, no thanks, I'm good for now.
I'm going. And she went off. Yeah.
And she went off.
Yeah.
And we understand that there was like some health reasons that were going on there and there were other things, but she also just made the decision that she wanted to focus on herself and her family. And those are things that I probably would have been really kind of cruel about when I was a teenager, just thinking, oh, fine, again, another woman who has to choose family over, you know, whatever.
You get it now though, right?
But I mean, I get it a little bit more. Like, I don't think she necessarily sacrificed anything. She had done amazing things. Yeah. She wanted a break to do some other stuff. And now she's back making music on her own terms.
Her own terms, yes.
So happy for her.
Me too. I get it's even more poignant because of where you were about her and where you've come to, you know. Before we take a commercial break, let's all have a listen to one of your favorite Shania tunes. Whose bed has your boots been under? Here is Shania Twain.
Whose bed have your boots been under?
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, and I'm here with pop culture expert and author of You Ought to Know, Andrea Warner. And we're talking about some of your favorites. Your favorites, clearly, and I think probably deep down still, I don't know, were always Alanis Morissette and Sarah McLachlan. They were your real feminist heroes, while Dionne and Twain were not only relatable to you, they made you mad at the time. And yes, they've evolved for you. But as you write, you set your heroes apart from your enemies. And I know you had this wonderful image of a lot of this came from your favorite children's book series, The Babysitter's Club. And I was actually telling a hairdresser, she goes, I love that. Like, it's so funny how we all have the same, right? We all have the same mythology and references. And,
absolutely.
You know, it's so cool. She's like, oh my God, that's so amazing. I'm going to read that book. And of course, for those who don't know, The Babysitter's Club centers on 4 very different 13-year-olds who open a babysitting business. And clearly for you, Chrissy was Celine. Chrissy's best friend was Shania. Your favorites were Claudia, who most resembled Alanis Morissette. Stacey was the ultra cool girl from New York City who reminded you of Sarah McLachlan. And so I want to talk about your love and admiration for Alanis and Sarah, but let's start with Alanis, because she burst into your consciousness. You admired her candor and her realness and her authenticity and her anger and how screwed up everything was and how she expressed that near volcanic rage in Jagged Little Pill and all of this. Can you tell us more about the impact of Alanis Morissette on your adolescence, your feminism, and just your musical tastes?
Absolutely. I still, to this day, think Jagged Little Pill is basically a perfect record back to front.
Yeah.
It holds up in every way, shape, and form. And I remember, like, when I heard You Ought to Know for the first time, I think I was probably on the radio and probably, like, I don't know, my dad was probably driving the car or something. And I remember there being motion and me feeling like everything was stopping. And I was just like, what is this? This is amazing. I really felt like I hadn't heard anything like that or someone who sounded like Alanis before, yes. Really. I did not put it together as a teenager that this was the same dance pop Alanis from a few years earlier who had sang like Never Too Hot, Never Too Cold.
Yes.
I had no clue. Like I was just like, no, those are different beings. That does not make sense to me. It did not compute for a while. But when I got my hands on the whole record, and it still to this day, it kind of stuns me. There's just the whole spectrum of adolescence, and not just adolescence, but adolescence where you're forced to grow up a little too fast.
Yes.
And you have that, you've got these experiences with adult things that you probably shouldn't have to deal with or contend with when you're a child. And I felt like that record captured that so perfectly.
Yeah.
And it's not just the anger. It's not just the sexy bits that let's face it, I was more aspirational at that point than actual experience, but you know, it's fine. But it's not just those pieces. It's like, there's so much humor. There's so much sort of observational storytelling happening.
Yeah.
There's different pieces about self-esteem and trying to form your identity and having these intrusive outside voices and thoughts sort of impacting your, just like your ability to figure out who you are. And it's already so hard when you're a teenager. And it's already so complicated. And then you have all of these other things that you think you need to be doing, or you think you need to live up to, or you think you're not allowed access to.
Right.
And so I just feel like Jagged Little Pill kind of acknowledges and validates like that whole spectrum of how screwed up it can be to be a teenager.
Yeah.
And I think like all of that, sort of seeing myself in all of the different tracks that I saw myself in. And when I didn't see myself, I saw a clear understanding of the world, or I had a way to name things that I hadn't had a way to before. It gave me sort of a language and a sound and a feeling that I could sort of cling to. When I could do that, I think it really did empower me to sort of dig deeper into understanding feminism, understanding things like learning words like agency, learning from, I sort of started to like seek out different feminist scholars like bell hooks, and it really sort of like helped me turn a corner into sort of my broader emotional education and sort of like my, again, that further iterations of yourself, how we're always sort of like these new iterations.
Yes.
That really made such a difference and such an impact on me. And even now, like when I went and saw Jagged Little Pill on Broadway, I flew to New York and I saw the show, like the second to last preview the night before it opened, I think. And I just wept a lot. It was so good. And I reviewed theater for a long time, so I know the pieces of it that aren't as good. But overall, the show is so good and it's so ambitious. And again, it's really trying to, the timelessness of the things that she's talking about in Jagged Little Pill were so easily sort of updated and rearranged to talk to the moment that we were in 2019.
Wow, wow, wow. So thrilled. I bet you couldn't leave your seat. I know that feeling of being in a seat in a Broadway theater like this or any theater and it's over.
Yeah,
everyone's getting up.
And you're just like, I can't go. Yeah. I am here forever. I guess I am. I just live here now.
I live here now, and I want to.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's lovely. I have to tell you, your titles and the table of contents are so good. Okay, so I want you all to hear this one, Sarah McLachlan. Okay, saint, sinner, feminist, friend, and funeral staple. Like, no, I wondered, like, how long did it take to write those? Because, wow, that's really taking all of it. Like, I am obsessed with Sarah McLachlan. I have a daughter who's a singer, a musical theater singer and artist living in New York,
cool.
Yeah. And people always tell her she sounds like Sarah McLachlan. So that might be part of
what
it.
What a compliment.
Know.
That's so great.
Yeah, but there's something about her, and your writing about her is so exquisite. The way you talk about Sarah McLachlan, I hope I'm quoting you properly here, but how in the arms of an angel, it feels like a warm body's embrace. Can you speak to that beautiful ballad, The Arms of an Angel, and what it means to you, what it meant to you, and what she means to you, and why she impacted you so intensely.
Yeah. I mean, I think like with Sarah, I feel like she came into my life pretty early on. Like I think 1993 was, maybe even before 1993, maybe 92, I can't remember. Anyway, there was something so compelling about her voice. And I loved how she could sort of go into that, I think the upper rafters I talk about sometimes, and she can go into that sort of deeper register. And especially when sort of some of her earlier work, when she was really sort of willfully quite weird.
Yes. Before we talk more about your love for Sarah McLachlan, I just want to play a bit of one of your favorite Sarah McLachlan songs, Ice Cream.
Your love is better than ice cream, better than anything else that I've tried. Your love is better than ice cream. Everyone here knows how to fight.
Wow, that song is so fantastic. Tell me more about what you love about Sarah McLachlan and her music.
I was so in love with that permission to be experimental, to feel that I could just, like, there weren't limitations on what I could put into the world and what I could feel, you know, because I think a lot about Sarah's work is understanding sort of the emotional, sort of like the deep emotional reserves and really tapping into it and making us confront some stuff sometimes too, you know? Mm-hmm. And there are countless songs of Sarah's that sort of have done that for me. Yeah. Arms of an Angel. I think that is sort of where she gets into a little bit more territory where she has found sort of like this sweet spot of confronting grief and still understanding the beauty and gratitude of having experienced love. So I think like, and I think that's really hard for a lot of us to understand sometimes and remember. Because when we're deep in the loss, we're just like, this hurts so much.
Yes.
But like, we all know that it hurts so much because the love was so important.
Well, that
was so big.
Grief and love. And I thought of this when you wrote about your beloved dad, who passed away at 39 years old. And I'm so sorry about that.
Thank you.
And I can just picture him in the furniture shop and you and your sister carting around with him, and just what a beloved man he was and how much he loved you. How much, like, I felt the love that he had for you in the book that came across.
That's good. Thank you so much. Yeah. He was wonderful. And I was a little hesitant because I wrote a lot of poetry when I was in high school, and I was a little hesitant to share that. And he would sometimes get frustrated with me. And one time he was like, well, you understand. And I mean, I don't know where he even came up with this, because like, if I'm thinking about it clearly, I don't know that this was a man who had necessarily ever really gone to a poetry reading in any way, shape or form. But he was like, well, if you're going to be a writer, you have to, like, you have to have readers. That's just that's just part of what being a writer is. Yes. And that has always stuck with me. And I shared some stuff with him for sure, because we had a creative writing anthology that was published every year in our high school. And then we also had one for high school students at UBC. And I was in both of those like a few different times. And so he saw those poems and stuff before he passed away. So he had some idea of like what I was doing with my time and my life and stuff. But it's nice that I can like, I mean, obviously he stays alive for me and my family all the time, every day. But it's nice to give other people a sense of him through this work.
Yes. I felt him. It was really,
thank you.
Really, really powerful. Yeah, really powerful stuff. I also love when you talk about that last 2-minute instrumental song on Sarah McLachlan's album, an instrumental, which you felt was a secret high five for McLachlan. You appreciated it so much. Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. So like, I love those moments of weirdness where we hear an artist trust their gut. And that's how I feel about, that's sort of where I feel like Jagged Little Pill and where I feel Alanis and Sarah kind of meet, is that even as we sort of see them move into sort of arguably more mainstream records that have like these sell.
Yes.
We still see them trust their guts on the sort of impulses of that other people might say, hey, why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't imagine the conversation around Jagged Little Pill of like beginning and ending with You Oughta Know and then having the secret, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I can't even imagine the conversation that was happening with record executives. And then for Sarah, she's just like, okay, yeah, so I've made this much more mainstream record.
Yeah.
We are anticipating that is going to be my global breakthrough. 2 minute instrumental. That's what we got to do. We got to bring it home with a 2 minute, like on what planet is like, and I love that though, because mm-hmm. I do really feel like those are moments for like the truest fans.
Yes. I was going to say for the truest artists and the truest fans. Yes.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. That's lovely. She also created The Coolest Thing, which is Lilith Fair, an all-female music festival in the 90s. And Alanis Morissette was one of the artists who performed there. So it's all interwoven. What was the significance, just briefly, of Lilith Fair?
Well, Lilith Fair was everything to me. I mean, I went to it in 1997, its first year in Vancouver. And it was the first time I had ever gone to a sort of like women-centered festival where it was that women were just given the priority. It wasn't, I mean, I remember back then even people were like, oh, we're keeping men out? Like, no, it's not a binary.
Right.
Like saying that you're going to prioritize women is not saying no men. I don't know how you don't understand wording, but whatever. You're telling on yourself when that's your objection to Lilith Fair, gotta say, buddy. Anyway, but I just remember like being there and just being in these like huge crowds of people and were singing en masse. And it was my first time seeing Indigo Girls. It was my first time really truly like seeing like just fields of drindle skirts, you know, and seeing the way that people were coming together. And I mean, there were so many different people at Lilith Fair. Like it was a place that felt extremely crowded and extremely safe.
Wow.
And we were all invited to some kind of campfire sing-along.
Wow. So great.
It was
great.
What
a privilege. What a gift to have been able to experience that. My goodness.
Well, in all honesty, like, you know, we were talking about like my dad, like he had just died at the end of 96. So I still had all of 97 that I was sort of like facing at that point. And it was during my high school year. And so Lilith Fair was like a few weeks before I was going away to university. Yeah. I was leaving home. I had had this massive disruption in my family life. And I was there with my best friend at the time.
Yeah.
It felt truly both cathartic and empowering. Like I was being given a send-off that I could sort of anchor myself to as like this moment of, again, that empowerment.
Wow. That's so fabulous. That's so fabulous. You say, I'm going back to Alanis for a minute, that Alanis Morissette saved your life and gave you a voice. Just tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, I really don't think that I could have... Like, I can't really imagine my life without Jagged Little Pill. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what that could look like and for who I am and where I'm at in this world and sort of the places that that record took me to and allowed me to go and invited me inside, like to understand that I could hold all of these different truths about myself. And I didn't have to be one thing. I didn't have to feel one way. I knew that there were confines on me as a young woman.
Yes.
And there were all of these different stereotypes and expectations. And like, and I've always been like a fat young woman. Like that's just, there are things about my identity that are sort of politicized that I can't control. Jagged Little Pill was one of the first times that I kind of had a true understanding that they didn't have to hinder me.
Yeah.
That they could actually fuel me.
Yeah.
And that I didn't have to be like ashamed of things.
Yeah.
And that really did set me up for something different.
Wow.
To understand that like I wasn't alone or whatever, which I think is important, but like there's lots of different ways to figure out you're not alone. Again, like sort of that refusal to be ashamed.
Yeah.
Refusal to be shamed by other people and other people's expectations and by what people have done to you. Jagged Little Pill just told me, no, all of that is nonsense. You do not have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was empowering. You were being given the license to just be empowered and be yourself and step into your best self and just lift off, you know?
Yeah, I'm so grateful to her for that. Like, for the rest of my days, I will always be grateful to Alanis Morissette. But honestly, I think all four of these women truly shaped me in every way humanly possible. And I just am, I'm so glad that I've been given this opportunity to sort of think about that, write about it, and share it in this way. Cause like that's, yeah. I'm so privileged. I'm so lucky.
We're going to go on a short commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk all about Olivia Rodrigo and really how all of these people, Shania, Celine, Alanis, and Sarah, revolutionized the music industry. We'll be right back after this short commercial break.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by Create, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
Create is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. Create is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, Create is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. Create has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? Create Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about Create Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. This is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, and I'm here with celebrated music journalist Andrea Warner. And just before the break, we were about to talk about Olivia Rodrigo. I mean, there's so much in this book, and we don't even have time for all of it, but you write about Olivia Rodrigo, who has been talked about as an angry person who feels all this rage, and the connection between her and Alanis Morissette. Briefly, what is it?
So Olivia Rodrigo, when I first heard Driver's License, I was like, oh, this is a spiritual sister to Alanis. Like, yeah. Absolutely. Like, she's got the anger, but she's also got the humor, and she's got the vulnerability, and she's got the love, and she's got all of the emotions happening in this one song. And it's so good, and it's so easy to sing along with, and it's doing stuff that, like, it felt pretty unique to her at the moment. And then we find that her and Alanis sort of connect together after, because a lot of other people also obviously
noticed that,
realized that there was a connection between You Ought to Know and Driver's License. And so they were brought together again and again. And then Olivia Rodrigo makes this incredible speech at an induction for Alanis and just talks about like how important it was for her to have that music to pave the way for her music and for herself.
Wow.
And yeah, I feel that.
Great.
I feel
That's
that so,
so
much.
How do you think that Shania, Celine, Alanis, and Sarah McLachlan revolutionized the music industry in the 90s and beyond?
You know, I think that they were utterly true to their vision of what they wanted to put in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they were encouraged to maybe do other things, be other people, try other ways of existing.
Yes.
I really do feel like Celine was gonna Celine hard, always. Shania figured out this like combination of finding a producer that she felt she trusted and that could give her the voice that she wanted to put into the world.
Mm-hmm.
Alanis rejected a lot of things that she thought she had to do and then found her own people to make the music that she wanted to make.
Nice.
And I really firmly believe like Sarah crossed the country and made her own sound and space for that sound here in Vancouver. Mm. And then the industry told her, you can't do this. And she said, try me. And she did it.
And she did it. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, wow, wow. There's so much that I want to say. There's something that I really want to get to, because I said off the top that there were so many things that surprised and delighted me in the book. And for one was that you really are an erudite, acclaimed, accomplished, exquisite writer, but you are. You're a journalist. You're a poet. And so I was so surprised and delighted to discover that as a teen, you subscribed to Soap Opera Weekly, then actually got an internship there. Well, first of all, briefly, what was that like having an internship? Because I was a bit of a soap opera addict. I'm embarrassed to say. I'm not sure if you were or this was just a gig for you. But
I love soap operas. You are in safe company here, my friend.
The Young and the Restless?
Yeah, of course. Young and the Restless was my go-to. I lost my first tooth in front of Young and the Restless. Like, I am telling you.
Oh my just God. Really, like, I can't even say on the air what happened to me, and the only rest of us have to say this on the air.
Fair enough. So I didn't even subscribe because the subscription would have taken too long. I went to the store every Friday because we got delivery of the Week Ahead's magazines on a Friday afternoon. I went to the store and I bought it with my allowance every Friday. And I specifically bought Soap Opera Weekly, not Soap Opera Digest, because Soap Opera Weekly I thought had better journalism, and it did. And then when I was in university, I was supposed to be doing creative writing. I signed up for journalism by mistake and I really liked it. And I sent an email one night just because I was like in my dorm alone. And I was like, hey, do you ever do internships at Soap Opera Weekly? And the person, Gabby Winkle, love her to death. She wrote back and she's like, absolutely. And, you know, like if you want, apply and you can come. I'll look at your application. And so I did. And the following year, after I was in the middle of a 2-year journalism program, I left university. I went and did my internship at Soap Opera Weekly in New York. I was there for 4.5 months. And then I became their horoscopes columnist for 2 years.
Yes. Now, I'm going to ask you this. Do you like horoscopes, or was that part of gig?
No, I love horoscopes. And it was still a gig, but I love horoscopes.
And like guess
it was.
What? We have grandmothers with the same sign. So the love of my life that raised me when I was very little, starting at 3 years old, was my grandma Lily. Who my Lily was named after. Her birthday. And so I want to ask you, was your grandmother's birthday October 31st or November 1st?
October 31st.
So was mine.
Wow.
So I read that and I just got the shivers.
Wow.
And I
want
to make sure I read it correctly, but that was so cool. So best birthday ever, right? Like the most loving Scorpio beyond. And guess what?
Absolutely.
I went and married someone born on that birthday, October 31st.
Oh, wow.
He always says, if I was born on November 1st, would I have been out of luck? And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. My best friend, October 30th.
That's
like,
crazy.
I know Scorpios and I love them.
When's your birthday?
I'm an Aquarius. I'm January 25th.
Nice,
so it's coming up.
Nice.
And it's
happy
and Aquarius
birthday.
And Scorpio.
Happy almost
Thank
birthday.
You. Thank you.
That's so
Aquarius
great.
Aquarius and Scorpio, not really usually much of a combo, but I love them.
Oh. What a loving human that birthday is. So I get who your grandmother was. I just read that. I was like, I know her grandmother.
Oh, that's she's a delight. She is sleeping in the bedroom right now. She lives
I
with
love
us.
That. Now, they say that a healthy and loving relationship with your father, which you had beyond and in spades, reflects the relationship you'll have with your partner. And it looks like you have found the most amazing relationship with your partner. And I love that. Evidently, every time you get into the elevator with him, you kiss each other passionately and you take a lot of elevators because you live in a building with an elevator. So can you tell us about him and about that? Because that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say like necessarily passionately every time, because sometimes it's just like a quick lip kiss, but sometimes it's passionate for sure. Yeah, no, we have been together since 2006. We met online and we turned out we had some friends in common, and we had like, he has a master's in publishing. I was in journalism and writing and stuff. We've been to a lot of the same concerts. He is an excellent proofreader, an incredible writer himself, like just so clever. And he's so smart. It's ridiculous. I have street smarts. He has trivia smarts. So we are a good combination together. It's pretty good. every elevator ride we've ever taken since like, I don't know, the first month we were dating, like we have kissed in the elevator. And I mean, COVID for sure took a little whack out of it, but we would just touch masks.
That's really
have
romantic.
We've lived in this building 15 years.
That's a romantic, like seriously, you have to pause and just let that one
sit with that one. We're very fond of each other.
That's really, really beautiful. Like really, really beautiful. I just have to say one thing. Oh my God, there's so many things I have to say and they're telling me to wrap it. After reading your book, I became obsessed with the song One Hand in My Pocket. Now I know that song, but after reading the book, I started to listen to it again and I was so obsessed with it, with the video of her singing One Hand in My Pocket. What do you think about that song, about her singing that song and writing that song? Do you love that song? I don't know.
I do love that song. I feel like it's so, if you think about it just from like a pure sort of the things that you take for granted is that we all stand around and usually there's like one hand in our pocket. And then we think about like, just the approach that she has to the world. And it's so common and it's so normal. And it's just like thinking about what you can do with even the most casual effort and the most, I don't know. I really love that she is talking about class. She's talking about labor. She's talking about creativity and she's talking about peace and she's talking about justice in this song in such a really like fun way.
Yeah. So clever.
And she just, she Yeah, she wants the world to be as good as it can be.
Of course, as we all do, as we all do. Yeah. I love that song. Very quickly, if you had to make a 4-song sampler of the best 90s songs from each of these 4 artists very briefly, what would you choose? Celine.
Okay, my answer fluctuates to this all the time, but Celine is tried and true. All Coming Back to Me Now. It's my favorite Celine song. I love it so much. For the rest of my life, I'll always love it. Sarah McLachlan, right now, I would like to choose Ice Cream. I almost never choose Ice Cream, but today I'm choosing Ice Cream because it's really sweet and I'm feeling now romantic thinking about the elevator. For Shania, I'm feeling sassy. I want to go with Whose Bed Have Your Boots Been Under? I think that is a fun, fun song. And Alanis, today I want to think about the song Perfect. Nice. I think that we all can ease up on ourselves a lot and understand that perfectly imperfect is the way to be.
Who is this book really intended for? Who is this book for?
I mean, it's for me.
Yeah. Good for you.
Like, it is for me. And I think it's for like anyone who wants to think more deeply about their feminism and how it factors into their tastes and how a lot of people, especially like people like me, we're just always confronting our internalized misogyny, always understanding new aspects of it. And like when you grow up in patriarchy, when you grow up in this culture, it takes a really long time to undo stuff. And I'm just going to be always undoing. And then the one hand in my pocket is doing the undoing. The other hand is sort of building back up and relearning and learning how to be like a better person.
Beautiful. There's a question that we ask everyone at the end of the show. And of course, we're going to ask it to you as well. What is bliss for Anvia Warner?
Oh, I mean, honestly, right now, bliss for me is Aquafit. I love swimming. I love being in the water. I had like a very hard year last year. I had cancer. I'm fine. Oh, goodness, I recovered quite well and stuff, but I really had to build up my pelvic floor and my body again and just like come back into myself. And I've done it in the water. And it's been such a wonderful, I mean, I'm an Aquarius. My sign is the water bearer, but that's actually like an air sign. It's like mental airwaves and stuff. Yeah. But I do love the water and I love being in the water. And so Aquafit has been so good for me to just play in the water and Aquazumba, Aquafit, deep end, shallow, whatever. I like love it all. Oh, and lovely. I'm just getting out there and in there as much as I can.
Andrea, I really love this hour with you. Honestly, as you've seen, I have a million more questions. You're going to have to come back.
It would be so delightful. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. And thank you so much. Like you are, like, I just want to carry you in my pocket and like have you hype me up to people because that's like amazing. Thank you so much.
You're so wonderful. What is the best way for people to contact you, connect with you on social media? And of course, to get a copy of your beautiful book, We Ought to Know How Celine, Shania, Alanis, and Sarah Rule the 90s and Change Music.
Your indie bookstores are absolutely the best places. I strongly encourage you to go there. Ask your library. If you want to ask your library to carry the book, that would be amazing. Get it from there. You can Audible. You can find me, my website, so embarrassingly called theandreawarner.com. But Andrea Warner was taken, so I had to go with the. Sorry. I'm on Instagram for now at Miss Andrea Warner, if you want to find me there.
Lovely. Thank you. And blessed. I'm feeling the bliss because of you. So thank you very much. Each week we spotlight a fabulous person like Andrea Warner who's living their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, yoga, meditation, or mindfulness expert, or really anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we would love to hear from you. We also love to feature singer-songwriters on the show. If you're one of those, please reach out to us. Also, what did you love about today's program? Are there any guests or topics you'd like us to feature on Finding Your Bliss? Just write to us at fyb@findingyourbliss.com. For those of you who don't know, I'm also the Bliss Coach. That means I help you find your passion and purpose and help you get connected to it. Just reach out to me at findingyourbliss.com/coaching. I'm also on Insight Timer, the number one free meditation app. And all you have to do is search up Judy Liebrack. And of course, you can always find us and follow us at The Bliss Minute on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. I would like to thank our wonderful guest, Andrea Warner, for being on the show today. Also, thanks to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kiley, producer Eva Shabatai, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Juliana Yanniciello, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.